Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Making Sense of Recent SLE Clinical Trials, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Greg J. Silverman, MD. Dr. Silverman is a professor of medicine and pathology, co-director, Musculoskeletal Center of Excellence, New York University School of Medicine, New York, New York. Dr. Silverman has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Biogenetic, Genentech, and Roche. Dr. Silverman does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Silverman does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to provide an overview of the current standard of care for the management of SLE, an understanding of the pathophysiology of SLE, and the potential role of new biologic therapies. This activity is supported by Human Genome Sciences. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Greg Silverman, Professor of Medicine and Pathology and co-director of the Musculoskeletal Center of Excellence at NYU School of Medicine in New York. I'm here to welcome you to this Medscape CME video lecture discussion entitled Making Sense of Recent SLE Clinical Trials. Our educational goals today are to review the current state of the art of clinical care for lupus, provide an overview of pathophysiology and roles of B cells, and also look at new biologic agents in clinical development and review recent results from clinical trials. So SLE is not an uncommon disease. The overall prevalence in the population is between 1 in 1,000 to 2,000, but unfortunately in some populations it's even more frequent. For instance, in African-American females, 1 in 250 patients or individuals would be afflicted. So there can be very heterogeneous clinical manifestations, as you all know, and we're learning more about the genetics, but it's very complicated. And based on genome-wide scans, at least 30 different risk factors have been identified to date. So to discuss the treatment of systemic lupus erythematosus, we should appreciate that the standard of care currently, in most cases, is based only on small series and open trials that have been reported in the literature. Until earlier this year, in fact, the FDA had only approved three agents, aspirin, hydroxychloroquine, and corticosteroids. And these approvals were really grandfathered in agents and were not based on randomized controlled trials. So when we treat our patients now and we use other agents, things like nonsteroidals or methotrexate or pulse medrol or IV cyclophosphamide or mycophenolate mofetil, it is not based on approved FDA usage and it's not based on randomized controlled trials. And actually only one agent to date has been approved by the FDA based on randomized controlled trials. So we should appreciate that lupus is a very complicated disease, and here's a figure from a recent review, which I actually suggest very highly. It discusses a number of different pathways that can be involved in self-perpetuation of this systemic autoimmune disease. And I'm not going to go into this at any great length, except to say that there are many different cell types that are involved. Very prominent, we think, are plasmacytoid dendritic cells, shown at the left of the field, immune complexes with autoantigens, usually released from the nucleus, DNA as well as RNA-related molecules, and these actually will be taken up either through Fc receptors or through the antigen receptors of B cells. And there is cycles that are induced that result in stimulation of cells through toll-like receptors, the release of compounds like IL-6 and alpha interferon, resulting in the production of plasma cells, more autoantibodies, and destructive immune complexes, as well as the release of survival factors like B-cell activating factor, as we're going to discuss at greater length. So the pathogenesis is very complex. There may be important differences between individuals, and we're learning more as time goes by. So the best news, actually, is that a disease that was once considered an orphan disease and of little interest for the development of new agents all of a sudden has been appreciated to be a very, very hot area for the development of new agents. 21 different agents are now in clinical trials, and I'm not going to go through each of these agents. They are targeting a number of different molecules and cell types. I think for today's program, it's important to appreciate that there are a number of different ways to target B lymphocytes, either through surface molecules like CD20 or CD22, or through soaking up their survival factors, like B lymphocyte stimulating factor, also called B cell activating factor, or APRIL, which we're going to discuss at greater length. Later this year, there's going to be more reports on success of these trials, as well as against alpha interferon, which seems to be a very prominent factor produced in a number of lupus patients. So let's discuss more about BLyS. So BLyS is a molecule that was discovered something like 12 years ago, and it has a very specific function as it plays a role in ensuring the survival of B lymphocytes. It is a member of the greater TNF family, and it can be produced at very high levels by a number of different types of leukocytes, from neutrophils to monocytes to dendritic cells and many others. And health, only low levels are produced, but during inflammation, much higher levels can be produced. And this seems to be very important in perpetuating the existence of autoreactive B cells that otherwise would be deleted as part of immunologic tolerance and health. So stimulation with TNF-alpha, IL-2, or interferon gamma can increase levels. This molecule is initially produced in a membrane-bound state, and then it can be cleaved off by local enzymatic action, and these factors can then get into the circulation or permeate through tissues to affect B cells, sometimes in very adverse ways. The active form is a trimer, and that's what interacts with one of the different forms of receptors that are available. But again, it's very important that BLyS is present because it plays essential roles in B cell maturation, survival, and differentiation. So in this schematic, we get a better idea of the different roles of BAFF and APRIL. We also show when CD20 and CD22 are expressed. So what this figure is showing is that throughout our lives, we continue to generate new B cells from stem cells that are in the bone marrow. And these cells will undergo sequential stages of differentiation to pro-B, to pre-B cell. They go then become immature B cells, transitional, and so on. And it's only after they become mature B cells that they have antigen receptors. And so there are different stages of differentiation, that stage which is antigen independent, as they say, and those that then are antigen driven. But the point is that at different stages of differentiation, surface molecules change. So only during intermediate stages of differentiation can we target B cells through the recognition of CD22 or CD20 by newly developed agents that we'll discuss later in the program. And then the survival factors, BLyS and APRIL. There's a variation in their dependence on these molecules. APRIL seems to be more important later in differentiation for plasma cell generation. So we're going to discuss next are the recent and very successful phase 3 trials of a monoclonal antibody called belimumab, which targets BAFF or BLyS. They're the same molecule. So the design of these two trials, these pivotal trials called BLyS-52 and BLyS-76, two very similar trials but performed at different centers around the world, involved a large number of lupus patients. It's really quite remarkable. BLyS-76 involved 826 patients. BLyS-52 involved 865. There were very stringent enrollment or inclusion criteria. You had to have a very active salicylate. It's a disease activity marker that can measure disease activity composites in different organ systems, and you had to have a level of 6 or greater. Also, very importantly, patients had to be seropositive, meaning they had to have a positive antinuclear antibody of significant titer and or the presence of an antibody to double-stranded DNA. So this would actually document that patients had immunologically active disease. Patients were also on a stable standard of care regimen for at least a month. They were trying to limit the range of clinical manifestations, and there may be very great differences in patients that have severe lupus nephritis or CNS disease, so these were excluded from the trial. And there was also oversight on the use of therapy so that there were progressive restrictions on the use of agents such as corticosteroids as the trial progressed. These patients were then randomized into the standard of care placebo group or a low-dose belimumab treatment group that also got standard of care, or the high-dose belimumab treatment group with standard of care. So together, these were two multi-center, randomized, double-blinded, placebo-controlled studies. BLIS-76 was conducted from centers that were primarily in North America and Europe. BLIS-52 involved centers at other sites, and there was very specific dosing, as indicated here, dosing at day zero, and then again in 2 weeks, and then in another 2 weeks after that, and then patients continued to be treated every 28 days with this intravenous therapy, and were followed for more than a year in each of the two trials. There were pre-designated stratification criteria to look at response to therapy, and it had to do with screening Salinas-SLEDAI scores, as indicated here, or the basis of proteinuria, and also ethnicity or race. The primary endpoint was a combined response index at week 52, which we're going to discuss at further length. So this was really a great advance for clinical trials and different from trials that were reported previously. Based on FDA recommendations from panels of experts in lupus, it was decided that improvement and significant improvement in pivotal trials should require improvement in disease activity, but also show that there's no evidence of worsening of the disease in other organ system involvement. In practice, the primary endpoint for this trial, BLIS-52 and 56, had to do with this responder index that involved three different components. It was that you'd show a decrease in the Salinas-SLEDAI greater than or equal to 4 points in this scale, and then a lack of flares of disease activity using the British Isle Lupus Disease Activity Scale. And in addition, they used the Physician Global Assessment that had to do with overall patient's condition, and they have a scale that's been used as well. And I have to say that due to time limitations, we really can't go into each of these different these systems well-known to clinical investigators, and here actually validated to a very high degree based on the results of the trial. The BLIS-52 response rate at 52 weeks showed statistically significant differences in both the low-dose and the high-dose treatment groups, as we can see here in the scale. And this shows you that there were separations between the curves somewhere between 4 and 8 weeks, and then they would plateau shortly thereafter. So if we actually break it out to the different components, and we're comparing response rates between placebo and the low dose or 1 mg/kg belimumab treatment group or the high dose treatment group. And again, all three of these groups also had standard of care that they were on stable regimens before starting. You can see that there were statistically significant differences with regard to the Salinas-SLEDAI differences, which required at least a 4-point reduction of disease activity. Also that there was no worsening in the physician's global assessment, and no new BILAG was actually worsening. It was only seen in the high-dose group, and it was just a trend if you look at the low-dose 1 mg/kg group. With regard to adverse events, which addresses safety, in fact, this was a very well-tolerated therapy with very comparable frequencies of overall infections or serious infections, and really there was a very low rate of discontinuation due to tolerance or safety issues. Infusion reactions were noted, but they were not significantly greater in the low or high dose group, and there was no association with malignancy. Actually, the results were very similar in the outcome of both the BLIS-52 and the 76 trials, and overall, we can see that these major findings were found to be true, that they attained at 52 weeks, that the combined responder index was attained, and that, in fact, there was an increased time to severe lupus flare, which is very important in treating patients. Overall, patients that were on the active arms saw a decreased need for corticosteroids, so there was a steroid-sparing effect. Also, using other measures, there was reduced fatigue as early as 8 weeks in the active arms of the treatment group, improved physician global assessment as early as 4 weeks. There was also evidence that autoantibodies, such as anti-double-stranded DNA, improved over time, and that complement levels increased over time, also suggesting that there was a reduction due to the therapy of immunologic activity during the disease. So in general, the agent was very well tolerated and suggested that this agent might be useful in a clinical setting in addition to standard of care. So overall, the cumulative experience from these two phase 3 randomized clinical trials is very encouraging. They documented reduced disease activity in the patients that got active agent, and particularly with regard to patients that had involvement of the mucocutaneous, musculoskeletal systems, as well as with regard to their immunologic activity. when there was a retrospective analysis, it looked as though the patients that were most immunologically active at entry had the best clinical benefits. These patients were identified based on entry with low C3 levels, low C4 levels, and higher levels of IgG anti-double-stranded DNA. A secondary endpoint, which is very relevant to clinical practice, is that a greater number of patients in the active arm, those receiving belimumab, had reduced requirement for daily oral corticosteroids. These patients in the phase 3 trial, as well as those in the earlier phase 2 trial, were enrolled in an open extension trial that looked at that has now more than 6 years clinical experience with almost 450 lupus patients and a total of 1,500 years of experience in lupus patients. And it looks as though the responses are durable and long-lived, and the agent continues to be well-tolerated. The pooled safety data together from the phase 2 and phase 3 trials cumulatively indicate that this is a well-tolerated agent. There is limited evidence to suggest that patients suffer any kind of increased susceptibility for infections, not statistically significant. There are really no increases in opportunistic infections or tuberculosis, and no increase in malignancies that have been documented to date. So that reviews the experience to date with belimumab, a very exciting agent, which, as I said, was approved by the FDA for the treatment of lupus earlier this year. As we compare that to the experience with rituximab, a monoclonal antibody that targets CD20 on the surface of B cells, as we all know, this was approved quite a while ago for the treatment of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and there's been a cumulative experience for the treatment of a number of autoimmune diseases, but it is really only approved at the present time for rheumatic diseases, for the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis, that have patients that have had inadequate response to TNF agents. Very disappointing were that two randomized controlled trials with rituximab failed to meet their primary endpoints. These have been reported over a year ago. The EXPLORE trial that looked at non-renal lupus and the LUNAR trial that looked at lupus nephritis. In retrospect, the experience that we're now gaining with belimumab and with eprituzumab that we'll discuss in a bit makes us wonder whether the study design was really optimized and whether or not we can now learn lessons that may merit re-examination of other agents. With regard to real-life experience, there were reports at the recent EULAR meeting that suggested that a review of 164 lupus nephritis patients that were in 9 centers in the UK and Spain that fulfilled the criteria for lupus and had biopsy-proven disease actually got significant benefits. They were looking at patients that had WHO type 3 and type 4 disease. They had very rigorous criteria. The requirement of response to be documented was a complete response, needed normal creatinine in active sediment, and less than a gram, a half a gram rather, of urinary albumin. Partial response was 50% improvement in these parameters compared to baseline. And the results were actually quite exciting. And suggested that at 6 months, you might be able to attain a complete response in 27% of patients, and a little bit better at 12 months, up to 30%, and that this actually was superior than what was believed to be the common experience with cyclophosphamide. Now, these are very difficult to treat patients. These were open trials. They weren't randomized. And so I think that this has to be taken with a grain of salt. They did think that patients who entered with nephrotic syndrome had a bad prognosis and were less likely to have clinical benefit, more likely to go on to renal failure. The author's interpretation of their results was that it was supportive of further investigation for rituximab and lupus nephritis that were refractory to standard treatment or those who had experienced a flare after intensive treatment. There was another report from a European registry that is looking at lupus patients that are given a biologic. And a number of patients were studied in this group, and the cumulative experience was examined. So again, this report was meant to reflect something closer to a real-life experience, and there really was no standardized regimen that was used. In fact, more than half the patients were receiving concomitant IV cyclophosphamide. So of 317 patients, again, treated off-label with rituximab, this is not an FDA-approved therapy, that was the predominant choice of physicians if they needed to go to a biologic or a stronger agent. And these patients were representative of, I think, very common features found in American populations, average age being 40, about that a 90% female. They, in fact, found that at one-year follow-up, both the SLEDAI lupus disease activity reduced significantly down to a modest level of 3.5, and glucocorticoid needs were actually reduced, again, a steroid-sparing effect. And these were statistically significant compared to patients that received standard of care otherwise, and overall suggested that there may be a reason to re-examine rituximab in the future. Again, there are a number of biases in these studies. They're not controlled or randomized, but it suggests that at least there are some physicians that are taking this route and this choice. Moving on next to another agent which is very promising for the future, eptuzumab. Eptuzumab is a monoclonal antibody that targets CD22, which is present on B cells during intermediate stages of differentiation. It has a very different mechanism of action than rituximab in that it really only causes a very mild blood B cell depletion, but there's also this functional inhibition of B cells which remains poorly understood. There may actually be an agonistic effect stimulating through CD22, an inhibitory pathway. The observation here, which I think was very exciting, these were randomized controlled trials, it's a phase 2 trial and very small, as we'll see, is that the designers of this protocol actually came to a very similar design than we saw in the earlier belimumab trial. Criteria for improvement was a combined set of criteria that you'd have to have a BILAG improvement from baseline, no deterioration in the SLEDAI total score, and no worsening in the physician's global assessment. Also that the patient did not require the addition of a new immunosuppressive or significant increase in glucocorticoids, and that patients to be shown to be responsive also could not withdraw from the treatment arm with eptuzumab. In retrospect, most failures were due to the BILAG criteria, so this appeared to be the most rigorous of the four different criteria set out. Here we can see the response rates. I want to point out again that this is really a very small trial, much smaller than described for belimumab. The arms are in something to the effect of about 37 patients in each group, and it was a very short follow-up up to 12 weeks. But we can see that after about 8 weeks, the groups appear to statistically significantly separate, and there is really little or no difference between the two different dosing regimens for eptuzumab. So this may be very exciting, and it may suggest that eptuzumab would be more rapidly acting, and responses were seen in a number of different organ system involvements. So this table is very complex, and we're not going to really go through it at any great length, but just so that you can review it at your leisure. This shows all of the adverse events that may have occurred in the different treatment groups. And of course, there were a number of different doses that were evaluated in the trial with this agent. And the important take-home lesson is that there really is no statistically significant difference between the placebo group that got standard of care and the different eptuzumab treatment groups. So in general, this agent was very well tolerated in patients that had moderate to severe lupus. So a follow-up to that controlled study, we now have pooled data from two completed open-label pilots, as well as three placebo-controlled double-blinded trials that included the EMBLEM and other open extension studies, a total of 308 lupus patients and over 360 patient-year exposure, showed basically that there were good clinical response rates and a very attractive safety profile. There were some infusion reactions at higher doses, and of course, there were some very serious adverse outcomes. There were three deaths with pneumonia, chronic heart failure, but it did not appear to be statistically significant. This will have to be more closely examined and considered in the design of future trials. So lupus trials in general have been a very rocky path, and I have to say that it's encouraging to see what recent results are, because until recently there was no successful trial with lupus. And the question is whether the agents were inadequate, whether they weren't potent enough, whether they were targeting the wrong cells and molecules, or I would argue that, in fact, the primary outcomes were just not as refined and appropriate as is needed to be able to look at patients that have such heterogeneous clinical manifestations. So future design will take this experience and I think Putting a light on a successful path will benefit everyone, and in the future we may also be able to consider how patients vary based on their genetics, perhaps by differences in environmental factors and pathogenetic pathways that may be dominant in different individuals. It's still an unresolved issue how to best manage background immunosuppressants. It is not ethical to remove agents that patients require to be able to lower their disease activity, even if it makes a more clear understanding of the effect of a new agent. There may also be regional and global differences in the treatment of lupus, so when you enter your patients, they may not only have different genetics, environmental factors, and other features, but they may well be on different background agents. So, and as time goes by, there have been changes in our standard of care. We're adopting new agents. These will be incorporated as the background immunosuppressants for our patients. A very good example, of course, is mycophenolate mofetil. Has a very said to have a very good response rate, even though it failed in its clinical trials to show a superiority, but it's been adopted as a commonly used agent in many centers, although really not FDA approved. But the other thing that I'm concerned about is that when you're using different background agents and testing an experimental agent on top of that, we may not have any idea of what interactions these different types of agents may have together. So whether or not we can have fair comparisons and understand outcomes, I think, poses new challenges. There are also challenges with regard to using disease activity scores that seek to survey across many different organ system involvement. I think we've had a very positive experience with the SLEDAI scale that has been developed sequentially and improved over the years. A more recently introduced scale, this British Isle Lupus Activity Scale, I think has been shown to be helpful, but in fact is better at showing whether or not you have deterioration, while SLEDAI may be better at showing improvement since the institution of a new agent. Do we need other measures? Is there a need to look at not just these disease activity scores, but those that measure damage or cumulative injury to the organs? And steroid sparing is very, very important because it's a very common part of many patients' day-to-day regimen. But there is a lot of toxicity with regard to steroids. And I think if we can wean patients off their steroids, we may well be able to see benefits from new agents and the a lessening of the adverse events of background agents. So in the future, we need to better detect the influence of a study agent and also consider ethical issues with regard to study design and the use of modest levels of background agents. So a number of conclusions include that advances in our understanding of lupus pathogenesis are providing new therapeutic opportunities. In particular, eptuzumab continues to show promise in mid-stage trials, although in a limited number of patients so far. Rituximab, although unsuccessful in recent randomized clinical trials, has shown benefits in open trial studies, and we'll see whether or not it bears reexamination in the future in light of recent developments. Ongoing investigations may lead to better clinical trial design and better use of background agents. Of course, the results from the recent BLIS 52 and 76 trials represent the first phase 3 trials to attain their primary endpoint and also validate this SLE responder index. So in summary, recent results on the treatment of lupus with belimumab show that there were decreases in the SLEDAI general disease activity rate as well as in flare rates after only 3 to 6 months of treatment, and there were also sustained decreases in lupus autoantibodies over time. As a result, in early 2011, belimumab became the first FDA-approved agent for the treatment of non-renal lupus based on randomized controlled trials. Now there's been more than 6 years of open extension surveillance and experience that have documented benefits in lupus patients in multiple organ systems, as well as evidence of its glucocorticoid sparing effects and durable responses. So this new agent is providing newer opportunities for treatment of our lupus patients, and experience in the BLIS trials have also provided, I believe, a path for clinical trial design for the evaluation of other agents in the future. So I thank you for joining us for this Medscape education activity. And remember to continue on to the post-test, which you need to do to obtain CME credit for this program.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Making Sense of Recent SLE Clinical Trials. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.